The Helly Kesser Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HellyKesserJane.com. Listen to me, Steve. Drive. You've got an amazing drive. You stayed with this through thick, through thin, did all sorts of crazy jobs. But talk to me about that, the drive. Do you feel driven?
Well, I have to make an admission. Not have drive. What I have is, in fact, I am an underachiever. Really always have been. And I've always had people in my life that gave me either a leg up financially or patted me on the back just when I was about to quit or give in. I've had the support of my wife for 29 years plus. And like I said, music teachers, family.
Did he say underachiever? That man who just called himself an underachiever is one of the most recognized voices in rock and roll history. For nearly 10 years, the lead singer for the iconic band Journey. Steve Ogeri, the man with the golden voice, will be joining me at my table in a moment. But first, hi, and welcome to the Helly Kesser Jane Show. I am Helly Kesser Jane. Today, the Helly Kesser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/The Helly Kesser Jane Show. And remember, the Helly Kesser Jane Show is always available online at HellyKesserJane.com. And a host of venues, including iHeartRadio, Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and Blog Talk Radio. Google The Helly Kesser Jane Show, and you will find us. Best known as the lead vocalist for the rock group Journey, the original Arena Rockers, from 1998 to 2006, Steve Ogeri recorded 3 albums during a successful 8-year tenure that brought the world's most accomplished melodic rock group back to the stage for multiple world tours for millions of fans. Debuting with a bang on the Armageddon soundtrack, racking up 7 times platinum with their song Remember Me, following the success, Steve went on to co-write and record on Journey's Arrival, Red 13, and Generation CDs, as well as to be featured on their Journey 2001 DVD, which is embraced by Journey fans the world over. Crisscrossing the globe, performing for millions, proving why we don't stop believing. Prior to joining Journey, he was founding member of Tall Stories. The group released their eponymous debut in 1992. After the band disbanded in 1996, Steve joined the group Takedo, with whom he recorded the album Shine. At present, he fronts the Steve Ogeri Band and has released a slew of singles, including In the Moment, and continues to tour worldwide. Let's talk. All right. So maybe you have, listen to me, one of the best voices in rock and roll ever. Do you hear me?
Oh, my God.
This is true. So I got to tell you, so all week I'm listening to your music while I'm researching your life, and I'm distracted. And I'm thinking to myself, wouldn't I like that voice just whispering sweet somethings in my ear? I mean, geez, Steve, seriously, when did you discover you had this voice? This is an amazing instrument you have. Talk to me.
Well, first off, that's an amazing compliment. And you know, it usually gets me pretty, I'm kind of uncomfortable with being the center of attention. I mean, it's fun most of the time. The other most of the time, I'm very, very shy, very introverted. So if it weren't for the stage, I'd be the guy in the corner, you know, with the blending into the to the wallpaper. So, you know, early on, I guess I had a wonderful teacher in elementary school, and I guess, you know, they had, back in the day, they were called glee clubs before there was the glee club, and I had somebody who heard a spark in me, and he took me and he kind of nurtured me and kind of pushed me towards a singing career very early on. I wish he were alive today to see exactly where I ended up, because I'm sure he'd be smiling. Perhaps I like to think he's smiling down on us right now. So,
you were born in Brooklyn, raised in Bensonhurst to parents, mm-hmm. Joseph and Emma Ogeri. I told you Ogeri, I looked it up because I love the name. It's so beautiful. And it means powerful and complete. How do you like that?
Well, sometimes I'm powerful.
Sometimes complete.
Far from complete.
But a work in progress, right, like the rest of us. But listen to me, how about your parents? How did they feel about your going for the music thing, and did your voice come from them?
Well, my dad dabbled in drums. There was, when I was growing up in our garage in Bensonhurst, there was a huge, back in the day, they had these huge, enormous bass drums. Kick drums, bass drums, and it was, so he did play as a younger man, but I never ever saw him on a drum kit. However, in the rafters of our garage was this beautiful big bass drum, and I don't think I ever had the opportunity to have it down and bang on it a while, but it kind of disappeared somewhere, I don't know when, but so Dad was a player, and Mom was a music lover, and she used to sing to me all the time, anything and everything, silly songs. My grandmother used to sing me opera. She used to sing O Sole Mio, and I used to try to mimic her. And so there was always music in the house growing up. And that's, yeah. I mean, I guess there was, in everybody's home, there was a music to a degree. And I have to say, though, probably more influential was growing up as a child in the early 60s or the mid-60s, AM radio was the king. And we used to listen to, I guess, it was a huge smattering of Motown and early rock and roll and great pop songs. And I think the Motown stuff really spoke to me.
Yeah.
And my dad also was a Motown fan, and he used to bring home certain records back in the day. And Sam Cooke was one of his favorite artists. And I think Sam was a big influence on me, which would later tie into the Journey sound, which had Steve Perry, who had a very big, in my opinion, had a big Sam Cooke influence as well.
There was the Frank Sinatra thing, but there was also, you mentioned it briefly, but I want to go there a little bit with you. You did understand classical music. I mean, you were, as a kid, a teacher put you in a play with classical music at some point? So there was a love of that too, right?
Well, yeah, the exposure came from back in the, I guess it was the early 70s or the mid 70s. There was our New York City public school system had some funds, and they were buying instruments and passing them on to the youth of New York City. And I was one of those lucky kids that first it was a clarinet, after the recorder, which everybody played. Then that music teacher at PS 48, his name was Frederick Terragrossa. He gave me a clarinet for a year. And then when I jumped to junior high, it was saxophone because it was a little sexier and a little hipper. From there, I guess I was kind of excelling in little bits, and I found myself in a borough-wide orchestra. And then come high school, this saxophone got me into a high school of the performing arts, which was Fiorello LaGuardia, which was famously by the TV show Fame and the movie Fame. And I lasted there for 6 months, sadly, because my grades suffered because I was so gung-ho about the music. I had gotten 100s in all of my music classes, but failed miserably at my academics.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. What goes on in that head? Everybody I ever knew who was a musician to the degree that you are, to the talent that you have, has a very special brain thing going on that's different. And I even think your hearts beat differently than the rest of ours. I swear to God. I mean, music just played in your head all the time?
Well, you know, that's funny because that's a blessing and a curse. But I have to say, I was fortunate enough. A lot of folks, you know, I meandered and kind of went aimlessly through life and a lot of, you know, without some direction. But early on, since the Beatles, there was a seed planted when I saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show. And then it took till I was 15 to really make the conscious decision, or at least a definite decision. This is what I definitely want to do. And, you know, I guess I put away a hockey stick and I put away my grades suffered, my academic grades, and just really wanted to become the musicians or my heroes that I saw on the Midnight Special and the In Concerts, Don Kirshner, and all these great TV shows back in the 70s. I wanted to do that. So I had forsaken everything else and put all of my effort and energy towards music. And ironically, it took till I was 38 years old, several years later, for me to get my big break. But sometimes that's what it takes, and that's it.
And that's it. But hey, that's okay, because you never gave up. And there were a lot of stories about you on the web. I mean, so many. It's ridiculous. Here's one. You went to college, but your tuition check for college bounced, so you returned home to start a rock and roll band? Is that folklore, or is that true?
Perfectly fine with me, because, again, this was a wonderful teacher and educator who took an interest in his students and in me, and he pointed me in the right direction. He tried his best to get me to go to college, but it just wasn't in my heart. So I was I was happy as punch to go back home. And, you know, but it took 20 years later to get my big break again, as I said, from 18 to 38.
Okay, so let's just stay around 18 or so. First band that you formed, first place you played. You remember all of that?
Well, I did have a three-piece band that, when I got real serious, I had a three-piece band that half of our music we performed was written by ourselves, because it was where it was at to create, you know. Half of being a musician, or being quote-unquote, well, successful musician, to me, is writing is 50%, and the other 50% is performing. So without the writing, you know, it's just performing, and then that's okay, but it's really fulfilling when you can create. So I love to create. So we did that, and the other half, and the other music we played were Led Zeppelin and Rush covers and Kiss covers, and mainly a lot of guitar-oriented covers. So I used to play guitar back in the day.
And where were you playing in those early days? I mean, when you were just a kid, you know, playing around. Were you playing at bar mitzvahs at weddings?
Yeah, you know, I don't think any smart bar mitzvah would have us. but we would play block parties, which were popular back then. And they're still kind of around, but they were very common. So you would play in a block down a street. They'd close the street off. This is for you folks living in the country and out in the suburbs. And every city block would get a permit. They'd close the street all day, and they'd have clowns making balloons, and they'd open up the fire hydrant, and they'd spray water, and everybody'd have a good time, providing the weather was good. And at night, somebody's friend of a friend or a cousin or a child, you know, somebody's son or daughter had a band, and they would perform. And God bless them, because everybody else had to put up with it. And the parents, of course, would be so proud of their children who had the band performing. But everybody else, all they wanted to do was play their Frank Sinatra records, and they wanted to hear Barbara Streisand. And we would come out and play Creedence Clearwater Revival and half, you know, slightly half-assed, and we'd play, you know, well, whatever the pop songs of the day were, and whatever we wanted to play. So there was usually a fist fight if there was alcohol involved. There was sometimes a fist fight or some kind, certainly an argument. But that's how we made our bones. That's how we learned, and, you know, put a couple of notches under our belt until there was an actual stage at a church dance or a school dance. Or back then there were battles of the bands, and these were good fun. These were great fun, and you know, we were just a bunch of kids getting our feet wet in rock and roll. And there was a lot of great talent, and I saw a lot of great talent come out of this, our neighborhood, and move on to bigger and better things.
Well, Brooklyn has created some of the great singers, artists of the day, of a generation. I don't know, it's in the water, it's in the pizza, it's in the bagels, who the hell knows, but it's fascinating how many people actually come out of there in all walks of the arts. Your parents were with you on this, right, or no?
Well, Mom and Dad were divorced when I was 8, so Dad was, you know, he was kind of a distant cheerleader, but he was a cheerleader. It was Mom who didn't have two nickels to rub together, to be honest with you, that would go out and buy me my amplifier and make sure I had a guitar, and, you know, and was always there. Now, she was also, in the same breath, she was always, I think the thing was always, go get yourself a city job with a pension and make sure you have a job that has, you know, the benefits. And you know, growing up from modest, especially not going to college, you needed some kind of security. And I think she would have been a great deal more happier had I had become a doctor or a lawyer. But that wasn't going to happen.
Was it her brother who gave you your first guitar? Was it Uncle Frank?
Actually, it was Dad's.
It was Dad's brother.
Again, he was also I don't think there were very many country western fans in Brooklyn, New York, going back in the day. But he found a love for it during World War II. And he made a bunch of friends, you know, I guess when you're in the army or the services, you meet people from all over the country. And he befriended some folks from, you know, from the southern states. And he became a huge Hank Williams fan. And when it came time to buy me my first guitar, he gave us lessons. He and my cousin and I, he taught us Hank Williams songs from a little Hank Williams songbook that he had won in a crap game going to and from Europe bring supplies to the soldiers fighting in Europe. So that was his job. And he went into the craft game, and I'm glad he did, because he hadn't, had he not, I may have been a plumber or a street sweeper or a music teacher or something else other than a singer. Or I wouldn't be having this conversation with you. We might be having a different conversation over, I might be serving you a latte at Starbucks.
I'd take it. As long as you were a singing waiter, then I would definitely take it. Listen to me, Steve. Drive. You've got an amazing drive. You stayed with this through thick, through thin, did all sorts of crazy jobs, some of which you mentioned. But talk to me about that. Where the drive. Do you feel driven?
Well, I have to make an admission.
Okay. You're not driven.
I do not have drive. What I have is, in fact, I am an underachiever. Huh. And I really always have been. And I've always had people in my life that have always gave me either a leg up financially or patted me on the back just when I was about to quit or give in. I've had the support of my wife for 29 years plus, and like I said, music teachers, family. And then once you achieve some kind of level of success, the last thing you want to do is go backwards, you know, like it or not, which I've had, you know, any music career or, you know, life has its ups and downs. I don't have to say that to anybody. So my career has certainly had its ups and downs. But ultimately, what you really want to do, if you really are passionate about making music and performing music, I've been fortunate to find myself back on the stage after I had fallen off of it. Figure two. Well, actually, literally and figuratively.
I'll bet.
Very honest with you.
But that's interesting to me. So is that more people on the outside saw your talent or understood your talent and more than you did?
I don't think I'd be anywhere without outside sources.
Wow. Great story. Great part to the picture. Your first real break. Talk to me about meeting Michael Schenker of UFO and Scorpions fame. He gave you your first job as a background vocalist, right?
Well, I was playing in a background band for a fantastic Brooklyn gal who sang for a band called Flame. And before Flame, her name is Marge Raymond. And Marge was managed by, back in the day, by Lieber and Krebs, who used to manage everybody, Aerosmith, Ted Nugent, AC/DC, on and on. And they handled Marge. And Marge used me in her backup band. And one day she went on, when Steve Tyler split from Aerosmith and Joe Perry, she went on to form a band with the remaining members of Aerosmith, which left the lead vocal spot open for me. And that kind of opened it up. So that's when this particular management noticed me, and there was a spot open for a lead vocalist, a background vocalist and a guitarist for Michael's tour. And they offered it first to my guitar player, and he just wasn't interested. And it was something that I just jumped on. So I didn't cut the guitar part, but they liked my voice, and they put me behind the amps and behind the stage just to sing background vocals, which was kind of common back then, but not particularly known.
It's interesting to me with that voice, that the power of that voice that you have, you playing background, I don't know, somehow it doesn't
fit. You know, thank you, but I have to say, did you see that wonderful movie, 20 Feet from Stardom?
No, but I will now.
Well, you must see it, because it's a wonderful movie about background vocalists. I'll leave it at that. But I've seen wonderful, they're just, you know, I'm one voice out of millions. And the other million, or the 9,099, or just... You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I've had a whole bunch of people who actually did start out as background singers. Yeah, it's just your voice is so unique.
99.99. Anyway, they're out there and they're talented.
Yeah.
You see them on TV shows and you hear them walking down the street. And in New York, it just seems like everybody else has a voice and they're practicing and going on to an audition or this and that. And I'm just one tiny decibel, a fraction of success that is so difficult to obtain, and I'm just one of the lucky few.
Leading to my next question. Interesting that you use the word lucky, because I was going to say to you, how much do you think luck plays in this game? And let me go further with that. Your bio says that while in the market for a new guitar at Manny's Music, you met guitarist Jim Maurer, and that meeting led to Tall Stories, the group nominated, by the way, for Best Debut Album, and you for Best Debut Male Vocalist at the 1992 New York Music Awards for Skyscraper. And wow, I mean, luck. But you got to have talent too, darling.
Yeah, well, you know, this is how I pretty much figured out. There are so many, you know, when everything collides and all these factors come into the middle of the axle from the sprockets of that wheel, you know, you need to be prepared and, but you don't get there until somebody opens the right door or, you know, there's just so many factors and yeah, luck is definitely one of them. But in addition to luck, you need to have what somebody's looking for. And you need to fill some kind of, you know, somebody's looking for this and you need to have it and boom. The next thing you know, and if you're ready for it, I mean, for example, when I auditioned for Journey, I had retired for a year and I was working at the Gap as a maintenance person. I was a maintenance manager. And when they did finally ask me, I begged for 2 weeks of preparation because I hadn't sang in a year. And you just don't have a voice if you don't sing after a month, let alone a year. So
let's, before we get to that, I want to go back because I want to get to Taketo. Mm-hmm. Talk to me.
Here was a really wonderful band. Well, after Tall Stories, and by the way, that was at Jack Mora, who's a hell of a guitar player, producer, songwriter, as well as all those guys in that band. They were a really brilliant band, Tall Stories. There was another great band that came out of this tri-state area. They were New York-based, but when I worked with them, they're out down in the Jersey Shore before the Jersey Shore was the Jersey Shore that everybody thinks of now. So there was this great rock and roll band holed up in a little bungalow, beach bungalow, and they asked me to come and help them write their next record. But unbeknownst to me, they had split with their lead singer, and I just thought I was going for writing sessions. So after 2 weeks of writing and what I thought was a pretty darn good rock and roll record, they asked me to join the band. And that's how that became. That came about, and it was. I'm really proud of that record. The only problem was that it shouldn't have been a Taketo record because they were a really wonderful melodic rock band, and they had a great fan base that expected more of the same music and more of the same style. And we had made quite a sharp turn on them, and we were doing something a little bit more Americana, a little bit more Southern style, a little bit more along the lines of a Black Crowes, which was kind of influenced by one of my favorite bands by the name of Humble Pie and a singer by the name of Steve Marriott, whom I happen to share the same birthday, January 30th. Anyway,
okay.
So I know that was a little long-winded, right?
No.
That's for a guy who doesn't like to talk about himself.
No, I think that was great. And I was just thinking, thank God it all happened in the Jersey Shore. I'm a Jersey girl, by the way.
Yeah, but I'm the king of the run-on sentence. So run
on all you want, darling, right? Just as long as you don't run on empty. Ha, 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 James. Oh, right. Right, there you go. But you got more? Okay. Tell me more. I'll stop. You talk.
So they were a fabulous band, and we released the record, but we should have had we would have had a little better success had we changed the name of the band and started out fresh, but the record company didn't want to do it. They put it out as Taketo, and unfortunately, there was a little backlash from their fan base. So as good as the music was, I just don't think it was meant to be. The timing was wrong. But it taught me a very, very valuable lesson when I went on to join my next band.
And what was that lesson?
That lesson was when I had the opportunity to work with Journey, that I would absolutely respect the music and more as or equally as important, respect the fan base.
That's certainly came into play. Let's digress for a second. Love, mm-hmm. Love comes to Steve Aggeri, or Andy Hardy or Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Lydia.
Yeah.
And then you have a son, Adam. Are there any more than Adam? I only know about Adam.
That's it. I met Lydia, let's see.
1966, 65, something in there?
36 years ago.
Yeah, well.
And it truly was love at first sight. It's incredible, but it's true. And we've been together, and she's been supporting me. And that's an incredibly strong woman, because this is not necessarily the most stable of individuals. And anybody in this crazy industry will tell you or know that there are a lot of Rockies, you know, a lot of ups and downs. And we've had some hard times, but we've really stuck it out, and we were just meant for each other.
It was that.
And I'm the lucky one. I'm the fortunate one.
You're the lucky one. But it was at that time that you kind of, made a veer towards more of a straight and narrow life and you needed to earn a living? And
well, I'll tell you what. Really what it was, you know, you make excuses, especially at younger when you're younger, and you think, oh, I can't get married, and I certainly can't have children, and I can't do this, and I can't do that. Well, you know what? Things, life has a strange way of taking its course and going by playing by its own rules. No matter how you think you could maneuver it and you can manipulate it, things happen. So I held off getting married till 7 years till I was absolutely sure. And then we had my child and I was kind of hesitant, but you know, I was so glad because it was having my son was probably the best thing that ever happened to me after meeting my wife, because it did take me out of that, that rock and roll lifestyle, and it forced me to grow up and be a responsible human being. I won't even say adult. You know, when you have to take care of a little bundle of joy, you know, you step up to the plate. Most of the time people do. And so I did, and I have him to this day to thank. So
that's sweet. And that's when you went to work as a carpenter for the Gap, which your father had been a carpenter, right?
Yeah, ironically, my dad had been a carpenter all his life. And when I actually started swinging a hammer for myself, he was gone. And I never had that father, the son, you know, little lessons in life, unfortunately. But yes, so ironically, you know, I always thought I was, Dad, I'm going to be a musician. I'm going to do this, and I don't need to learn this, and I'm not going to do that. And ironically, when he was gone, that's exactly what I did to put the dinner on my table to, you know, feed my family.
See what happens when you do the right thing and you put your family first. Luck comes back into play with you. Honest to God, you were the luckiest person walking on the face of the earth.
Well, check this out. I mean, you know, you had mentioned you were thinking about this drive and everything. I truly was a very big underachiever because it really, once I had let it go and I thought I had achieved my share in life of this, of music and my success, is when it came back for me. And I'll always be appreciative of that. It's when I let it go is when it came back to me and knocked on my door, which just blows my mind to this day.
That's an old, you know, Chinese thing, you know, let it go. And if it's meant to be, it'll come back to you. And there you go.
Yeah, you know, if you love somebody and you
set
and
them
smother
free,
them and you hold them too tight, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
The reverse can happen. And so that was, maybe that's what, maybe I was trying too hard. You know, the other crazy thing is, this is funny because lead vocalists, or at least what we thought we were supposed to emulate and we thought we were supposed to be like. Well, let's put it this way. The music industry is funny. They'll, if some wonderful artist breaks new ground and becomes the next big thing, quote unquote, the record companies, like most other industries, will say, I need something like that. So they'll say, hire me that. Find me an artist who does the same thing. And you'll see that in movies. You know, a great movie will come out and then 10 movies will follow suit and they'll kind of mimic it. And same thing with bands, right? So the moment I think I said, Steve, just be yourself and stop trying to, you'll never be David Lee Roth, and you'll never be Robert Plant, and you'll never be this one, you'll never be that one, is when you let yourself be and just become and just be yourself. And this is what I tell most people who ask me advice, and that's really all you have to do, just be truthful to yourself and just be yourself, and you'll be surprised at how things will just open. Your life will, you'll feel freer, things will come to you that never came to you before, and you're just, that's how you make true music and honest music. Or you're honest to you. Just be honest to yourself. And that's a good advice for the young whippersnappers.
They don't even know what the word whippersnapper means. I love it. So let's go back to this luck thing. So out of the blue, you get this phone call, right? From these two guys from Journey, John Cain and Nick Shawn. And you're offered this audition and you tell them, wait a minute, I have to take a little time just to get my voice back. And you go in and you audition.
Yeah.
And you get the gig. Are you freaked? What?
Well, first of all, I'm freaked out because I never thought it was for real, the request from these guys, the phone call. I thought it was a prank. And it was actually, again, getting back to people that were there to support you. It was a guitarist friend from Brooklyn who passed the music on to Neil Shawn. His name is Joe Cefalu, a fantastic guitarist. And then it was the finances of my brother-in-law, Nick Cirillo, who put up the couple of dollars here and there to finance me and get me to and from California on a couple of occasions. So, you know, it's nice when people are looking out for you and they have your back, so to speak.
Oh, that's sweet. That's very sweet. That's sweet that you acknowledge them, too. So listen to me, Steve. We just have to talk about this.
Yes.
When in 1998, you're officially named Journey's fourth lead vocalist and the first, quote unquote, official lead vocalist since the departure of Mr. Steve Perry, which is, I know what you call him, Mr. Steve Perry. You had to be scared to death to pick up that mantle, amazed that it was happening, insane to even think to follow in Perry's footsteps. Do you know what it is to me? It's like a Dickens opening line. It was the best of times and the worst of times. I mean, come on. I need to know this. I need to know. What the hell were you thinking when you said yes? You had to be scared.
Well, this is what I thought. First of all, when I left the audition, I turned to the two gentlemen, Neil and John, and I said, listen, if I get the gig, it's fantastic. But if I don't, it's going to be the best. It's going to be the best story I could tell my grandchildren. This will stay with me for the rest of my life. And more than anything, they had gave me the joy of singing again. They gave me the spark that I had lost for a year in my retirement at the Gap. And so I said, I'm going to go home and sing again. I'm going to start a band and do my thing. And as fate would have it, I got a phone call from them saying, you know, we're going to go forward with you and let's see what happens. And so,
where we're going with that is, where'd you get the courage to say yes and do it?
Okay. So I guess it took, you know, I'm trying to think of the word, the G-rated.
Balls, baby balls.
You know, where do I, the audacity, how do you have the balls to even think of replacing Steve Perry? So, but here's the thing. There was an opportunity. And again, I've always been an underachiever. And the one thing I needed to grow as a person was to get my act together and get some courage and jump out there and grab it, grab the ring on that carousel. So I took my I took my best shot. I tried to elevate myself. I tried to improve myself. I went and I started working out and I started rehearsing every day. And I started taking vocal lessons and you name it. I was on the self-improvement fast track, right? And, you know, then performing in front of the Journey audience was you know, there was going to be tomatoes, you know, rotten fruit thrown at me and vegetables and hate mail and death threats and you name it. All the things that you would expect because think of somebody trying to replace your dad or your mom and your family. I mean, that's... When you're a fan, a music fan, you know, it's like, you know, somebody gets divorced and all of a sudden you got a new mom or a new dad or something like that. It's going to take a while to win them over. So it did. It took at least a year and I was with them over 8 years and it took several years. But you know what? Eventually they softened and we started making new music. And I guess in the long run, they preferred to have a Journey. And again, I needed to respect them and show them respect. Then no Journey at all.
So. No, I'm going to argue with you on that. I'm going to say you won them over with your talent. That voice.
Well, you know what? Again,
you won them over with that talent.
There's a percentage that you're true. That's right. And there was a percentage that didn't even remember who Steve Perry was. And those especially were the young kids.
Right. And then, of course, you're always going to have the creeps, you know, who... and you
so
still
have... But you have to say the diehards.
Okay, well, you're nicer than I am.
And then there are haters. I mean, there's always going to be haters. But there were diehards that just out of respect to Steve would never have it. And I respect that.
So let me say this to you. 8 years with Journey, you racked up some pretty terrific credits. Remember Me from the 7-time platinum soundtrack for the film Armageddon. That was your debut, right? Arrival, Red 13 in 2002. The album Generations released in 2005. And the live DVD of the Vegas concert titled Journey 2000, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Right? That got to platinum status. But you also had a grueling schedule. Oh, my God. I couldn't even imagine. And so talk to me about this. What was the best of those years and what was the worst?
Well,
quickly, because I'm watching
the
clock.
The best times was living the life and going out and doing what you enjoyed most was creating and then performing your music. And not to mention, of course, singing this amazing catalog, which was the Journey catalog. And just, you know, there are a handful of rock and roll bands from America that can, and they're one of them that are definitely up on the upper plateau, the upper level, the top shelf. They're one of probably six, three maybe. So that's one of the highs. But what comes with that fantastic high is a lot of hard work and sometimes a lot of grueling, you know, the touring and being away from home and touring and touring and touring. And then a little illness went a long way and became compounded to the point where I lost my voice and was, well, due to several different medical issues.
Right. And before I go there, let me just go one other place, and I will promise I will take you back down that road. But because I want to establish this, because when I said that you were going to be on the show, you know, I got a lot of friends in the biz.
Mm-hmm.
The one question everybody wanted to say is that how about walking into the dynamic that was the remaining Journey, you know, group, and you inserting yourself into that dynamic? How was that?
Well, for the most part, Dean Castro and I, Castronovo and I, who joined at the same time, were asked to join at the same time. So Steve Smith, one of the world's famous and greatest drummers, rock and roll drummers, he and Steve moved on. And now you have fabulous Ross Valerie, bassist par excellence and funny man like nobody's business. Wonderful, funny fella. And John Cain and Neil Sean, who right there talk about dynamics, these two guys, sometimes like fire and ice, but when put together, create such amazing music. And then when you added Steve Perry, there was a magic there that was pretty wonderful. So I had the opportunity, again, to create with them. And so it was like jumping into the deep water. Sometimes with sharks, because these guys have been doing it all their life and doing it at such a high level of creativity that it taught me a great deal. You had to learn to swim and to create under these circumstances with these great songwriters. I mean, Faithfully, Open Arms, Don't Stop Believing. It was great. I mean, it was great. So it elevated me once again. The game had to go up. And by the way, this is my boy Buckley.
There he is.
My dog is just, I don't know if you can hear him.
I can.
Bobby, how you doing? And so I was welcome. It was a welcome thing to me. You know, it's great to be challenged and it's great to be put to the test every now and then, because it's too easy to become complacent and lazy.
So talk to me about this. First of all, there's a question that I want to ask you. Before I get there, I want to ask you this. I want to go back to the fact that Steve Ogieri, the artist, okay? Mm. Or as I call you, the man with the golden voice, I've given you a new name.
Oh, my God.
You can use it. That voice, your identity. And you said something, and it sparks this question. How difficult was it to be true to the artist in you, who is Steve, our Steve, singing Steve Perry's hits? How hard is that not to do Perry and to do you?
Well, you have to, I guess you had to keep one foot in Steve Ogieri land.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had to, again, you have to respect the music, and you had to, you couldn't veer off too far. You had to stay within certain parameters. And sometimes I probably didn't. And I used to hear about it too.
Right. Right. So somebody up there was controlling the way they wanted this thing to go out and to maintain the Journey dignity.
Yeah. I would lose focus, and I'll be the first one to admit it. But I have to say, in my long career, I've had the opportunity to work with some really great vocal coaches and or teachers and therapists. And one in particular, a fellow by the name of Mark Baxter, who wrote a fabulous book called The Rock and Roll Singer's Handbook or Survivor's Handbook. I used to read it daily, or bring it out with me on every tour, before every tour. Anyway, one thing he said was that your voice will never be healthy, or it would be healthiest if you're being yourself, if you're singing yourself. The moment you start chasing a sound and chasing one of your favorite, you know, vocalists, it's not going to be healthy. You actually wind up damaging yourself. So I had to keep that in mind. And frankly, that was pretty good advice, to be honest with you.
So my next question is, what's it like to be at the top?
It's a long way when you finally fall. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I mean, it's wonderful. Look, I'm happy where I am right now. I wasn't at the top. I was
You were at the top, buddy.
Involved in a band that was beloved by rock and roll fans, was given the opportunity to help revive. I think I was instrumental in that. And of course, I haven't been with the band for several years now, but I think with their new vocalist, Arno Panetta, I believe they are back on top with him. And that's, you know, I'm just a part of their success. So in my mind and in my career, it was the absolute, it was the tops. It was great. But you know what? Frankly, right now, I'm really content being not working as much as I used to. I work maybe twice a week or once a week, and I do a fraction of the shows I used to do every year. But now, because of that, I'm healthy and I'm happy, and really all you want to do in life is be happy. I tell that to my kid. I don't want him to be a lawyer or a doctor. I want him to be happy. So I'm happy. So, once again, in life, I'm happy. And that's
the most powerful thing that a person can be.
I'm smiling as I say it because it makes me happy to say I'm happy.
So is it fair to ask you at this point, then, is there a price to pay for fame and fortune?
Yeah, there surely is.
Yeah.
But it, again, it is what you make of it. If you have the right people around you, you can steer. And again, you can steer around those obstacles, or at least... And at times I had all those people, the right people were in place. So it is what you make of it. But it's easy to fall, you know, get out.
When you're at the top, the only place to go is
derail.
Down.
I mean, you're going to go down. You can go down very easily and derail. And then, you know, one moment you're everybody's best friend. The next minute, you know, no one's returning your phone calls. I mean, that you hear that story also many times.
So you had to leave. You made a choice to leave, or as rumors say, they threw you out because the voice was going. You had weird form of pneumonia. You know, you were just beat. That's all. You were beat.
You know what? The truth of the matter was I needed to step out of the batter's box, and that's my analogy. And it was the World Series, and bases are loaded, and maybe I was pitching, and the pitcher came in. And I mean, the coach came in and said, Steve, you know, you got to go back to the bullpen. You're all out. And that's basically it. I was unable physically to continue. And in retrospect, as difficult and as terrible a blow it was to my ego, you know, it kept I could have really damaged my voice and probably may not have sang again. So I got out when I was still, you know, able to have a little voice left to go work and put back together and sing another day. And I guess that's basically what I'm happy about today.
So what was it like to sing that last song with them, which was what song? Was it In Vegas, I think? I'm not sure.
Well, I want to say it was, unfortunately, thank you, YouTube. It was Faithfully, and it was terrible. It was, you know, I had no voice left, and thank goodness I had somebody in the band who has an amazing voice, Dean Castronovo, and he came to the rescue of the band and finished the song and the concert. But that, you know, that was the end of me for that time being, that's all she wrote.
And here's so interesting to me, because I know you a little bit now.
Mm-hmm.
You're a pretty spiritual kind of guy. And you're a pretty open-minded kind of guy, I think, too. So here you are. Now you're blank page again, starting all over, right from the beginning, right? You had your family, though, behind you. You had, you know, your family. You had your friends behind you. You had your kid behind you. The psychological trauma that you must have endured, first of all, the fact that you had to face the fact that you might not sing again, and that would be pretty lousy, and that you had reached a certain height, and now you weren't there anymore. What was going to happen next? Because I forget how old you were, but it was, you know, in your 40s.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who don't get knocked down that hard and don't get up. You got knocked down pretty hard, and you got up. How?
Jeez, well, you know what? I guess I was made of a little stronger, thicker skin than I ever thought I dreamt I had. And again, it comes back to the love and my passion for music. And I was given gift and the opportunity to work with Journey, and that meant something to me, a great deal something to me. And I know that there were a portion of the fans that might, you know, stick around if I wrote some music and put some music out and might come see me, you know, if I come in a smaller level and a smaller venue. And so I took a chance and I, you know, retooled myself and worked on my voice again and got myself back on the horse, so to speak. And lo and behold, the faith that I had, it was true, they would come. And just like when I was with Journey, we played 1,500 seat theaters, and then we ended up playing 15,000 seat venues. So did it start with my rebuilding of myself and my career and my voice. So we start small, and now we're doing pretty damn good these days. And we're, you know, I have a little break this next week, but I've just come back from Hawaii and Japan and Europe. And I'll be in Europe in a couple of weeks. And, you know, I'm just really lucky and fortunate that I can have a chance to, again, follow that dream that I've always had as a child from when I first saw the Beatles, you know, on television. It's what I wanted to do. And so, you know, it's one thing to get a first shot. Second chances are extremely rare. And I think I've managed to get that second chance.
And amazing work you're producing, which we'll talk about in a second. I want to ask you this, though. You're a singer. You're a writer. You play instruments, right? Fascinating. You're just like a little music box. That's what you are. But I want to ask you about this. What gets your juices going? Is it the song? The tune of the song? Is it the lyric? Is it, what is it?
I'll tell you what.
Talk to me.
You know, any songwriter will tell you this. It's really nice when it comes all together. And it can. You can have a song finished in 5 minutes. And then there are some songs, and although they'll be very worthwhile working on, it'll take years. I was waking up. I had a show in Honolulu with Kenny Loggins, fabulous Kenny Loggins, and amazing...
amazing musician. Yeah.
And the amazing Mickey Thomas. Jesus, what a voice Mickey has. Anyway, I woke up the day of show, and I'd like to sleep late, but instead I woke up at 6 a.m. and I had a chorus in my head. So I went to my phone and I sang into the memo and I recorded that, and I said, great, I'll go back to sleep and I'll have something to work on when I go home. Well, 5 minutes later, you know, now your mind is racing. This is what I was talking about.
Music in the head.
Blessing and a curse.
Yeah.
Now you're haunted by this song. So now the verse comes. So I go to my recorder and I hum into it, and I have a verse. And then 15 minutes later, you know, you can't go back to sleep. Now you have a keyboard line and so on and so forth. So now I'm just remembering the song, and I'm just – it's wonderful if you can get it all out at once. It is such a grand feeling. I don't know if there are many feelings when you have finished a song and you're really proud of it. And the crazy thing is I've written one or two songs that have literally brought me to tears. I don't know why. It just connects. I hope to God everybody else feels the same way. So
it's like good sex, or is it better than good sex?
It's better than all the sex in the world.
Oh, God. You lucky boy. You get to feel that. No, it's great that you can feel that. That's amazing. What's the song that was birthed that morning? Do you have a title?
Well, it's right now, it's the running title is called The Natural, but it could change because I don't have the lyrics for it yet.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, we'll look for that.
You know, if you have a song, there have been a handful, one or two songs in my career that have literally really, you know, resonated as if, I don't know, I'm not patting myself on the back by any stretch of the imagination. It just totally resonated and it really moved me. And I said, oh, geez, this is what it's all about.
So it's the Steve Ogieri Band, right? That's what you're, mm-hmm. and you've got an amazing website, and it's addictive because the songs are there that you can listen to that you go there. This new one that you have in the moment,
mm-hmm.
I love that song. I love that. I don't like that song. I love that song, but it's a little bit different. It has kind of an Irish thing going on in there or something.
Yeah. In fact, there were some bagpipes that I never made the final mix.
I just thought what you did with that.
I thought it might've been pushing it a little bit too much,
yeah.
But thank you. It's been in my head for years. It's been recorded. You know, I've recorded it several times, and It was just one of those songs that I had to release, and it was supposed to be the title track to my solo album, which never came to be because in this crazy day and age of music, it's just worthwhile releasing singles. So rather than save that for another year, I said it's about time I just let it go and put it out there. And
I'm glad you did, because it's really phenomenal, and it'll bring people to you. Do you sing in the shower? That just popped into my head. Do you sing in the shower? Do you?
I sing in the shower every day, but no songs. It's always my vocal exercises. That's when I warm up now. I do all my vocal exercises in the shower, and that's when I...
And you do like 2 hours a day of vocal exercise, don't you? Isn't that what I read?
I used to when my voice was in a crap condition.
Right. Now you don't.
Used to literally take me, because I think I used to be afraid to put the cart before the horse. Now I'm healthy enough to warm up in 20 minutes, just like everybody used to tell me. They used to say, Jesus, Steve, 2 hours, you should be done in 20 minutes. And so now 20 minutes, and when I hit that number, I was like, I think I'm okay. I think I'm finally physically, and my head's a little screwed on straighter than it used to be.
Well, good for you. I wish I could get
which
there.
Which is, frankly, there's something that I don't go preaching about, but just...
No, it's a great thing. I mean, why not? Listen, you earned it.
I took a little break from drinking, and I have to tell you, my voice, personally, in my personal opinion, it's jumped up about 20%.
Really?
Wow. So I'm thinking to myself, what was I waiting for? What kind of idiot? So now if anybody ever asks me, Steve, what do you do for your voice? I say, I keep away from the adult beverages.
Makes sense
to me. As much as I enjoy them, I love a good glass of wine and a great beer and a fantastic 12-year-old scotch or 18-year-old scotch. But I'll tell you what, as long as I'm singing, I'm going to be dry as a bone.
Good for you. Listen, we've talked about you as the singer and as the songwriter and as a person who likes to go on stage too and does his thing and gets past his own inner inhibitions when he gets out there. But and that you play and you compose. I'm wondering what scares you most. Losing your voice, listen to me. Losing your ability to play the guitar. Losing your ability to perform. Losing the ability to create songs. Or would it be losing your soul to music?
Well, I was on my way to losing my soul to music, you know. And frankly, I think by being taken out of the situation, being taken out of the equation, the journey equation, I think was saved my soul. I think losing my voice. Well, that would be at the top of the list, but I have to say, if I were unable to create, that would be the worst. And I'll tell you why. When I did finally go to the doctor, there's a fantastic medical center, Vanderbilt, in Nashville, and I used to go down there once a week and see a Dr. Cleveland. And Dr. Cleveland gave me the absolutely most simplest exercise to put my voice back together, like Humpty Dumpty falling off the wall. And I told him, I said, listen, doc, I don't care if I sing the level I used to. I just want to be able to sing a little bit. I'll pick up an acoustic guitar, and if I can just sing to myself, I think I'll be close to complete, getting back to being complete. We talked about that earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
I need to be complete. That will make me feel complete. And the first song that I sang with him was Someone Like You, the Rod Stewart song.
I love that song.
So he grabbed this guitar from the corner. It belonged to some wonderful country artist back there. I don't know who it was exactly, but and we sang it together. And you know, week by week, my voice built up a little bit more and a little more and more, my confidence. And that's it. I mean, I wanted it so bad just to be able to sing to myself or to my dogs or to my grandchildren. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're all part of each other. They're all connected, creating, but that's all I wanted to do. And luckily, by the grace of someone else, you know, shining a light to that path, they took me down the path of health, good health, and singing again. So, thank goodness.
Last question: best advice you learned to give yourself, Steve? Would Don't Stop Believing be on that list? Or as the title of your latest single says, In the Moment, Be Your Answer?
There's a connection there. But I think, yeah, you do have to believe in yourself. And as much as you need to look towards the future and revel in the past, it's important to live in the moment and appreciate what you have today, right now, this very, very, very moment. And believe in yourself, first and foremost. I mean, as I said, I've had great people behind me and supporting me and holding me up. But you'll be nothing if you can't stand on your feet. So, and what does that for me is trying to wake up and be as honest and as truthful to myself and to others. And that's my new credo, I think. Just, you know, be true to yourself. What did Shakespeare say?
To thine own self be true.
There you go.
I've been speaking with Journey's former lead singer and lead singer for the Steve Ogieri Band, Steve Ogieri, out with a whole lot of new singles featuring his voice of gold. Steve's latest single is In the Moment, in which he writes, "There is a time and there's a place. It doesn't have to last forever. A memory time can't erase, deep in the corners of my mind." Thanks for sharing your memories, Steve. For more information about Steve Ogieri and the Steve Ogieri Band, visit his website at steveogieri.com. His handle on Twitter, Ogieri Steve, and find him on Facebook at Steve Ogieri. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Helen Kesser Jane Show, a production of RESEC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HelenKesserJane.com.